From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, what the record heat means for workers outside and inside the office thermostat wars.
People tape cardboard over the air vents, or they try to tamper with locked thermostats. Some companies even install dummy thermostats.
Also today, making sense of our political ads. The positive:
bipartisan leadership has taken Massachusetts to new heights.
And the negative:
he doesn't bother to vote. Let's not vote for him.
Plus, a play based on the life of John Hancock's wife, Dolly, and the Hancock's enslaved servant, Cato.
These were real people with really complicated lives and relationships. And that's what we need to understand about history, is that it's not simple. And anytime we flatten out history, we don't really understand enough to ask the right questions today.
It's all coming up next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and we'll begin today with the heat, because it's hot. Like, really, really hot. We're in the middle of an excessive heat warning from the National Weather Service. Heat index 107. Of course, in this glass cage of a studio here at WBUR, the AC is cranked, as it is throughout our building, and office buildings across New England. Because with oppressive heat and humidity like we have today, comes what we're calling the workplace thermostat wars. And we want to invite you in on this conversation, listeners. Are you comfortable at work, or do you find yourself shivering at your desk despite the 100-plus degree temperature heat outside? Do you have to bring a sweater to work to stay comfortable, or is your office just right? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Is this a fight that you're fighting at home? Give us a call or send us a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. We're going to take your calls in just a couple of minutes, but first I want to turn to WBUR reporter Quincy Walters. He's on Boston Common, and he's been talking to folks who are working outside today. Quincy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
So it's really hot. It's summer. We know that. But what are people saying out there?
People out here are saying just as much. If you look out on the common today, you'll see people under shade, under trees, under umbrellas, and they're kind of hunkered down there and not moving. Yeah, people are saying it's really hot.
Right. So we've got this excessive heat warning in place for the entirety of the eastern part of the state, minus the Cape and the Islands, and that also is including Springfield. The rest of the state is under a heat advisory. What are cities and towns doing to help?
Right. So swimming at city pools is free of charge. Cooling centers are open at all 28 of Boston's Centers for Youth and Families facilities. Springfield has 11 cooling centers. Worcester has 2 spray parks. Over 20 Massachusetts school districts are closed or have early dismissal due to the heat.
So basically, stay out of the heat. And in terms of folks working outside today, I imagine construction workers or other people who are out there in the heat, what are you hearing from them?
So that's interesting. When I first went on this heat adventure, I went to a few construction sites downtown, and surprisingly, they were deserted. I came to Boston Common to see if I could interview people. I did happen across a group of construction workers on their lunch break, and Kevin Roche is a construction worker, and he says you kind of just have to push through the heat.
You just got to power through. You think about that shower at the end of the day, and that's what it's about, in that bed.
Well, yeah, we're all thinking about the end of the day, I'm sure. Did you find anyone else out there who was braving the heat?
Yes, I did. I spoke to Carmen Gutierrez, who was working at a slushy stand just outside the Tees Park Street station, and she says surprisingly she hasn't had too many customers today.
Not really.
And why do you think that is?
Probably too hot to walk around.
And are you staying cool, or?
I'm working on my tan.
So she's working on her tan, but not exactly good for business. Of course, all joking aside, Quincy, you know, the heat and the sun today in particular can be dangerous for certain folks. And so I'm curious about safety precautions. Did you hear any advice on staying safe in this extreme heat?
Yeah, so this morning I spoke with Jim Hooley with Boston EMS, and, you know, he says, of course, the people most at risk are young kids and the elderly, but he says also if you work outside, don't underestimate the heat. He says hydrate and ask for more breaks if you can.
And finally, Quincy, this isn't a long-term trend here, right? We're expecting it to cool down?
Right, so there's a cold front expected for tomorrow, and the temperatures are supposed to dip. Looking at the forecast this week, it looks like tomorrow will be in the upper 80s, and then after that, it will be in the 70s. The right temperature to get that pumpkin spice latte.
Ugh, too soon, too soon. Okay, WBUR's Quincy Walters joining us from the Boston Common. Quincy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So, despite the heat outside, I'm sure if you took a snapshot of workplaces across the region, you'd undoubtedly find a number of workers at their desks, maybe in sweaters, shivering from that cool air blowing from the air conditioning. But this isn't just a hypothetical. The conversation about workplace temperatures has become a real issue in the New York race for governor, where actress Cynthia Nixon is challenging incumbent governor Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic primary. Now, Nixon fired the first shot in the thermostat wars yesterday when her campaign requested the hall for their debate tonight be set to 76 degrees. Governor Cuomo, according to reports, has a preference for colder temperatures, with one former lawmaker saying he prefers it set to, quote, meat locker. Nixon's campaign says lower indoor temperatures are notoriously sexist. And of course, Twitter has become a battleground for people fighting over what's being called the thermostat patriarchy. So for more on this, we're joined by Sue Schellenberger. She's a senior writer and work and family columnist at The Wall Street Journal. She joins me on the line from Chicago. Sue, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Jamie.
Also with us on the line from Ithaca is Alan Hedge. He's a professor of ergonomics at Cornell University. Professor Hedge, thanks for being here as well.
Nice to be with you, Jamie.
Thank you. And I also want to remind our listeners, we want to hear from you on this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I know it's hot. I know it's summer. But is your workplace too hot or is it too cold? And do you think men have too much influence over the thermostat? Is 76 degrees reasonable or too warm for a debate or a house or a bedroom? You can call us again at 1-800-423-8255. Sue, I want to start with you because you wrote about this issue a while back in a piece called Let the Office Thermostat Wars Begin, and you talked to a lot of people about that. What did they tell you?
It's a battle in many, many workplaces. Every summer typically brings the commuters who come in all stripped down to stay cool for their commute, and then the air conditioning is all cranked up and they have to put on sweaters and mittens. Some people like it hot, as we see in the debate. Some people like it cold. It does tend to split along gender lines. And people are constantly trying to adjust the thermostat in secret or tamper with it or persuade the building superintendent to turn the heat down or up or whatever would suit their own metabolism. It is a real problem.
And Professor Hedge, you've done a lot of research on this issue. Does Cynthia Nixon have a point about office temperatures being sexist?
Well, she has a point that men and women have different preferences. Whether it's deliberately sexist or not, or whether it's just accidental, I think is debatable. But there's no question that in most buildings, you know, the buildings are too cool for the occupants, particularly for the women occupants.
Sue, in your reporting, did you find that this is a distinctly American issue? I know this is something, at least in my family, I have relatives who live overseas, and when they come and visit the U.S., they are surprised by how cool everywhere is, not just offices, but department stores and other restaurants. Everything is chilled.
I think there's truth in that. I'm not quite sure why we chill our buildings down so low. It's a good question. But, yeah, I think in Europe the prevailing temperatures are usually a little higher. I think essentially, though, it's, you know, 3 out of 5 people are dissatisfied at some point with their workplace temperatures, according to some studies I've seen.
And in your reporting, you talked about dummy thermostats that, you know, building managers might put up. Can you tell me about those?
Well, as you can imagine, building managers are hard-pressed to figure out how to resolve this. If, you know, one person wants it at 78 and the next person, as the governor does, likes it at meat locker, what are you going to do? Some superintendents admit that they have installed dummy thermostats, which make people think that they're actually adjusting the temperature, but they're having no impact whatsoever. And when I ask, well, what's the point, they said, well, people feel they have a little control and they feel better. Another thing that happens is that they field a lot of complaints. They put in apps or phone lines to field complaints about the temperature, and just having a chance to register the temperature complaint makes people feel a little better about it, even if the temperature doesn't change.
Professor Hedge, is there an ideal temperature for maybe an office to be at in terms of productivity, or does it depend on sort of a lot of factors and different
it
people?
It actually depends on a lot of factors.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that if you have men and women who are naked, they're going to like a temperature around 78 Fahrenheit. That's what the research shows.
But I'd imagine most offices are not,
you know,
that scenario.
That really doesn't happen very much indoors, right? So one of your challenges is that men and women dress differently. There's usually more skin exposed to the air with women. They're not often wearing pants. You know, they're not often wearing socks or sneakers. They're not often wearing a jacket or a tie or long-sleeve shirts. So clothing policy is really important here. You can dramatically change people's reactions to the environment by doing that. The Japanese have done this, by the way, very effectively. They have a program called Cool Biz. They set the summer temperatures to 83 Fahrenheit. And then they tell people you can wear shorts, T-shirts, you know, sandals, whatever you want. And that works perfectly well, saves a ton of money, and you don't get a lot of complaints about that problem. The problem here is, so one is clothing. Two is activity. That is, the more that you're stationary and sedentary, the less you're generating metabolic body heat. And then the third is, there is a difference. Men have, on average, more muscle mass. That generates more heat. They tend to have slightly better peripheral circulation to the hands and feet, so they don't experience cold hands and feet quite so much. And also, because they're usually wearing a shirt and a tie, they don't have as much neck exposed, and the neck is particularly sensitive to cold air drafts coming down from air conditioning systems. So all in all, it sort of is stacked against a woman, unless you control for all of these factors. If you're in, say, the military, you can do that. Everybody wears the same kind of uniform. But in most workplaces, that doesn't happen.
What about this idea, though, that, you know, okay, so we've taken into account that maybe more men in offices are wearing suits and ties and clothing that's warmer. What about this idea that layering up is okay, that you can just put more clothing on, but it's a lot harder to have less clothing, say?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that men should wear less clothing. Ditch the tie, right? I mean, they do this pretty successfully in places like California. Just taking a tie off and opening the shirt is going to let you deal with a temperature that's at least 2 degrees higher for the same level of thermal comfort. So ditch that. Wear lighter clothing, not heavier clothing. One of the reactions in Japan to the 83 degrees is they've developed very lightweight suits that add very little insulation to the body. And so they can still wear a suit, but they can be in a temperature of 83. So men have something to do. The idea of layering up is, okay, you see that. You go into offices, you'll see people with scarves around their necks. You'll see them, you know, with blankets and shawls on. You'll see them sometimes wearing gloves with the fingers cut out. The problem is that doesn't really help the extremities, the hands and the feet. It's hard to layer those up in a truly useful way. So there is research being done on foot warmers. You know, there are things out there that you can put your feet on that keep your feet warm, and that helps your
something
overall.
That you plug in.
You plug in, yeah. It helps your overall comfort as well. A lot of people take personal heaters into the workplace in the summertime, so now you're adding to the energy cost by heating the air up and then having to cool it down. And the building's already using, you know, I mean, buildings use about a third of all of our energy
right
here in the U.S. So it's a big waste of money. And just changing the thermostat is going to help a lot of people. You can go up to 76, like Cynthia says, without that causing any catastrophic effect on men at work. I'm in my office, which is not at the moment being really air-conditioned. The temperature here is 79. But, you know, I'm wearing jeans and I'm wearing a short-sleeve shirt, and it's perfectly comfortable. But so
Professor
you don't
Hedge,
have to be down at 72.
If I may, you mentioned energy usage, and I want to take a caller here. For it's Alan calling from Winchester. Alan, hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
I'm just listening to your discussion about adjusting clothing and lighter clothing, which is a great idea, and also talking about waste of money being excessively cooled. But there's another sort of health and money issue, and that is that when there's peak demand for electricity, as we have now, and officially between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. today, which is where we are now, it's record high consumption expected. And what they have to do for that is turn on dirty power generation, oil-powered generators and others, to generate the extra electricity needed, and that's actually bad for the environment, it's bad for our health. So, you know, if we have the thermostat up a little higher, it's better for our health and environment, as well as the other issues you've been discussing.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate you putting that on the table. And Sue, I want to turn back to you with that. I mean, the point that Alan in Winchester is making is that this extra AC that we're cranking all the time is also impacting our climate.
Well, it is, and I think that's one of the directions builders are going now with smart buildings. Many of the employers I interviewed were beginning to look at apps that can vary, you know, the temperature. If someone is particularly bothered by a 78-degree temperature, they can isolate that area and give it a little blast of air conditioning so that it's not chilling the whole thing down to these low temperatures. I think the smart buildings and recirculating air hold great promise for cutting down on our energy usage.
So maybe that's one possible solution. Alan Hedge, ergonomics professor at Cornell University. Are there any other solutions to this temperature war?
Sure, there are lots of things that you can do. I mean, a fan is actually quite effective at cooling you down, and it doesn't necessarily need a lot of energy if it's mounted on your desk, right? There are personal cooling systems. If you mist the air, add some water to the air, that's going to evaporate heat away from the body, and that's going to cool you down as well. So, you know, there are things you can locally do. Stay out of the sun. Don't get too close to a window if the sun is streaming through the window. That's radiant heat gain from the sun. You know, animals do this. Lions don't sort of lay out in the middle of the grasslands there when it's sunny. They get under trees for the shade, even though the air temperature is exactly the same. So, you know, there are things that you can do. Get up and move around periodically. Drink plenty of drinks. Expose as much skin to the air as you can if you are too hot. And if you're too cold, then you need to get up, move around to generate heat and cover up as much as you can. So there are lots of sort of things that you can do. But as people have said, the fundamental problem is we don't design buildings well. If you think of cars, of a car, say, you know, 10 years ago, you get in the car, everybody had the same climate in the car. Now you get in, the driver can set their temperature,
people
on the back seats. That's what we're trying to work towards in buildings, where everybody can actually select the kind of environment that works for them at that time, because what you want in the winter is not the same as what you want in the summer. So it's really important to sort of rethink office spaces in that way.
Well, that's Alan Hedge. He's a professor of ergonomics at Cornell University. Professor Hedge, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you. Also on the line is Sue Schellenbarger. She's a senior writer and the work and family columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Sue, thank you as well.
It's been a pleasure, Jamie.
Thanks. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Jamie Bologna, and you're listening to WBUR's Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We're going to turn now to politics, because Tuesday is primary day here in Massachusetts, so don't forget to get out there and vote. But as the election season truly heats up, like the temperatures outside, so have the political campaign ads, with some of the most aggressive attack ads coming from the Democratic primary race for the Secretary of State between incumbent Bill Galvin and challenger Josh Zakim.
Zakim failed to vote in 15 elections, even skipping John Kerry for president and Deval Patrick for governor. No show Zakim. He doesn't bother to vote. Let's not vote for him.
Bill Galvin says he hates the word progressive, and his record proves why. For nearly 40 years in office, he's betrayed our core values. But on September 4th, we have a choice, even if Bill Galvin doesn't respect ours.
That first clip you heard was from the Bill Galvin Committee, and the second from the Committee to Elect Josh Zagum. Well, here with me now to break down and to round up these political ads for this election season is John Carroll. He's WBUR senior news analyst and a professor of journalism at BU. John, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a Secretary of State's race, an important office, no doubt, especially with the security of elections in question. But it's a race between two liberal Democrats. So why are we seeing such a negative tone in this race?
Well, I think, you know, Bill Galvin has been in office for 24 years as Secretary of State. So he's fairly well entrenched. He's not used to this kind of challenge. Josh Zagum came out of the Boston City Council, and he's been really aggressive in terms of portraying Galvin as somebody who doesn't really have the progressive values mm-hmm. that Zagum brings. So, by the way, the Galvin ad is actually inaccurate. Josh Zagum didn't vote in 16 elections, not 15, according to Milton Valencia of the Boston Globe. So mm-hmm. he's gone after him on that, saying it's somebody who is going to be controlling the voting in Massachusetts who doesn't vote. That's kind of hypocritical. Josh Zagum says, basically, the progressive values that I bring, Bill Galvin lacks.
Right, and Zagum is going so far as to dig up Galvin's voting record when he was a state legislator back in the early 80s. This is something that came up in WBUR debate last week. And of course, again, this charge that Zagum hasn't voted in all of these elections. John, from a political strategy perspective, is it wise to dig so far back into someone's record for the campaigning?
Well, I think he's grasping at straws to some degree. And these are issues. He's talking about abortion votes. He's talking about death penalty votes that Galvin says were technical votes. But anyway, those things have nothing to do with the Massachusetts Secretary of State office. So Zagum is sort of going pretty far afield for that. One of the interesting things is, and it happens often, with a progressive challenger, basically the whole race moves to the left. So Bill Galvin has adopted a number of the things that Josh Zagum has accused him of dragging his feet on. Same-day voter registration, automatic voter registration, ranked choice voting, those kinds of things. So whoever wins this race, you're going to have a candidate who is further to the left than what Bill Galvin was when this race started out.
So, John, you're a former ad man as well.
And reformed ad man,
reformed
I like to say.
Okay. Recovering. But, you know, politicians always say that they dislike attack ads. What's the play here in Galvin Zagum in terms of getting voters' attention?
Well, it's interesting because people say they don't like attack ads, but attack ads work. And they're the ones that stick because, you know, when you have a positive ad and there's dogs and flags and kids and ice cream, you know, that doesn't really have very much impact. But an attack ad, just by human nature, tends to stick more.
So it worked for Reagan with Morning in America.
That was a whole different whole different issue.
Okay.
And I think that more often than not, negative ads are going to be more effective, and that's why people use them.
Okay, I want to move on to the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate. The three candidates running to challenge incumbent Senator Elizabeth Warren. We've got State Representative Jeff Deal, longtime GOP activist Beth Lindstrom, and Winchester businessman John Kingston. How are they distinguishing themselves in their ads?
Well, one of the things is Kingston is running $2 million worth of television ads. You know, that's way beyond what Deal and Lindstrom can afford. They're on radio. He's all over television. So I think that that's one of the issues. The other is that Kingston is running a general election campaign. He's completely ignoring Deal and Lindstrom and going after Elizabeth Warren.
And actually, we have some of a Kingston ad here. It's called Fenway. He's going after Elizabeth Warren. There's an actress who, you know, there's a shot of Elizabeth Warren played by an actress from behind, and she's loading up a Prius, and he goes directly after her. Let's listen.
Elizabeth Warren is done being our senator. She's already running for president. Like too many Massachusetts politicians, she'd rather skip the Fenway Franks and instead eat Iowa corn dogs. I'm political outsider John Kingston. I'm running for Senate to go to bat for you.
And then you also mentioned Jeff Deal's radio ad. Since we have a little bit from him, he's attacking Warren for being too radical a politician for the state.
Right.
Warning.
Elizabeth Warren supports abolishing ICE and making Massachusetts a sanctuary state.
So what do you make of these two ads? One's a little maybe humorous with this Prius image, and then literally warning bells.
Yeah, pretty funny ad. And he throws away the corn dog at the end. He's eating a Fenway Frank. So so that's the punchline for him. I think that the messages that they have are completely different. John Kingston is saying, look, I'll work with anybody if the objective is right and if the goal is right, to lower taxes, to pass term limits. So he's essentially looking to more to the center. Jeff Diehl is an ultra-conservative, very much in the Trump camp. He's had Herman Cain, Sean Spicer, Paul LePage, the Maine governor, come down and endorse him and do events for him. So I think he's staking out a position much further to the right than Kingston is.
But isn't that what you have to do? I mean, it's a Republican primary, and this is the party of Trump.
Traditionally, that's what's going to happen. But this is Massachusetts as well. So, you know, you've got opportunity for independents to take either ballot if they want, a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot. So it may be that Kingston is looking to lure some of them over to the Republican primary and try to capitalize on that.
So let's also talk about Beth Lindstrom. She's got a radio ad out, and you can hear a man at a diner ask his waitress to break down the Republican candidates for senator. She spends two-thirds of the ad sort of attacking the other two opponents and then ends the ad talking about herself as the best option in the race.
There is a better option, Beth Lindstrom. Beth Lindstrom is a small business owner who understands the economy. Beth Lindstrom is opposed to sanctuary cities. Beth Lindstrom also supports term limits.
Wow, Beth Lindstrom could actually beat Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's got my vote.
Now, how about a refill on that coffee?
So your take on the strategy here?
Well, I think it's a smart strategy, actually. What she's saying is that she's not a politician. She has a background in government. She was an aide to Mitt Romney. She was consumer affairs secretary. She ran Scott Brown's 2010 Senate campaign. Mm-hmm. What she's saying is, look, it takes a strong woman to beat Elizabeth Warren, and I am that person. And she has another radio ad that talks about how Warren is abrasive, Beth Lindstrom plays well with others, and so, you know, she's the one who can go and get things done down in Washington. So I think she's sort of got conservative positions, but basically she's trying to position herself as the most moderate, most reasonable choice in the race.
Right. I do want to go back to Jeff Diehl for a second here because he has a television spot that features Maureen Maloney. She's a mother who lost her son, Matthew, when he was killed by someone who was in the country illegally. And by the way, Meghna Chakrabarty has interviewed Maureen and her husband on Radio Boston. You can find a link to that interview on our website, radioboston.org. But I just want to listen to a little bit of that Diehl ad.
My son, Matthew Denise, was 23 years old. He was kind, caring, outgoing. He was more than I could ever have hoped for in a son. My son was killed by someone who should never have been in the country.
So this is a powerful emotional open. Of course, the ad goes on to cite murder statistics by those in the country illegally. Not only are those stats unsupported by the data, two recent studies have found immigrants in the country illegally are significantly less likely to commit crimes overall. John, just comparing that, though, to the Beth Lindstrom ad, I mean, that's powerful.
It's powerful. I believe it's on the web. I'm not sure that he's run that actually on television.
Okay.
But regardless, I mean, these things can tend to go viral. I think that the Globe tried to get some substantiation for these numbers that this video put out, and what they got back was just a mishmash. I think it's almost entirely unsupported, and I think that what he's trying to do is reach for the Trump wing in a very serious way with an issue that has worked for Trump over and over and over again.
So I also want to touch in, I know we're rapidly running out of time, on the 7th Congressional District. It's the race between incumbent Congressman Mike Capuano and Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. This has been a very tough reelection fight for Capuano. But as far as campaign ads go, is he outspending Pressley?
By far, he spent about $400,000 reportedly on television advertising. He's got
Wow.
two of them out there. And there's a realtors group that has spent $300,000 for Capuano, mostly on online ads, polling, and direct mail. So that's a lot of money arrayed against Ayanna Pressley's really modest budget. She's got a Spanish language ad running on Univision and Telemundo, and she's got some web videos, but basically she's kind of unarmed here.
Yeah, so actually we have both of those ads that you referenced. I first want to hear the Capuano ad from the Realtors Association.
From Chelsea to Randolph, Boston, and in between,
Mike Capuano is looking out for Massachusetts realtors and homeowners.
So what's your read on this ad? I mean, it's being paid for by an outside group.
Right. And I think that there's a lot of vested interest in this. You know, part of it is in FHA regulations. Part of it is in mortgage lending and refinancing of homes. So I think it's Capuano has been on their side in those kinds of issues.
At the same time, you mentioned that Telemundo Univision ad that Ayanna Pressley has. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Ayanna Pressley ha pasado su vida en lugares que los políticos raramente visitan.
Como concejal en Boston, ha sido una líder que nos entiende.
Of course, the translation is Ayanna Pressley has spent her life in places where politicians rarely visit. As a counselor, she's been a leader who understands us. I mean, smart move by Pressley?
I think so. If she's going to win this primary race, she needs to turn out millennials and voters of color. And I think that that's where she's going with this ad. And turnout's going to be everything in this race.
So one last question. I know we're out of time here, John. Professor Carroll, thank you for doing this. As we enter the final stretch of this primary campaign, are these type of ads, television, radio, traditional ad buys, still effective in the age of social media?
They're not as effective as they used to be. They're never entirely effective. Boots on the ground is always going to be more effective than advertising.
Well, that's John Carroll. He's WBUR senior news analyst and a professor of journalism at Boston University. It's great to have you in here, John. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie.
We'll be back in just about 90 seconds here. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is WBUR's Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and it's Wednesday, and so on this show, that means sports, beginning with the winning Boston Red Sox.
The batter will be Eduardo Nunez. Chopper, Riddle near the bag, taps it one on the first. It scoots by. Here comes Martinez. Martinez will score, and the Red Sox win it.
And after all those cheers, Red Sox fans everywhere put away their panic buttons for now as Boston beat Miami last night, 8-7 at Fenway, pulling it off in the ninth inning, barely avoiding a four-game losing streak. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer is in here with me now to help make sense of all of this because I think I've exhausted all my sports knowledge. Hi, Shira.
Hi, Jamie. You think I can make sense of
this? Yes, help me out.
I don't know. I mean, first off, like a warning for all Red Sox fans, don't like bury that panic button. Keep that handy because you never know as we head into September with the way this team has been going. I mean, they narrowly avoided their first four-game losing
streak. Right. I mean,
it was
a win, but they had to win on an error.
It was ugly. Yeah, they won. The Miami shortstop threw away a potential double play ball that allowed J.D. Martinez to score the game-winning run. And then if you want a longer version of what happened, the Red Sox had a 4-1 lead heading into the eighth inning. And of course, the bullpen was shaky yet again and got them into trouble. This has sort of become an expected drama, late-inning drama for the Red Sox this season.
This season or every season?
Every season.
Well, we actually have some tape here of Red Sox manager Alex Cora. Here's what he said about the team's pitching.
Now we need to get better. We know that. And we weren't good today. Too many pitches in the middle of the zone. We weren't able to spin the ball the way we usually do. Not able to pitch up in the zone the way we usually do. And we paid the price, but at the end, we won the game.
Paid the price. They won the game.
But the bar is high here. Let's not forget this is the best team in baseball, right?
Right. We're still leading the Yankees.
Yes, we still are. I like how you incorporate
yourself.
Well, right.
If we're winning, great. Otherwise, they're losing.
Exactly. I was going to say they have 91 wins. I think at this point they are 6.5 games ahead of the Yankees. Listen, they're going to win the AL East. Let's calm down, take a deep breath, get to some zen place here with the Red Sox if we can. Everything's going to be okay. They are playoff bound. They've had some hiccups here of late, but
It's going to be fine.
It's going to be fine.
Okay, I feel better.
Do you?
Yeah.
Have I convinced you?
You have.
Have I explained everything and straightened you out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Except for, okay, so I do want to talk about JD Martinez
because
he's been in the news this week for his Instagram game going back to 2013. Shira, tell us what he posted.
Okay, so JD Martinez, as a 25-year-old, mm-hmm. so this was about 6 years ago when he was not with the Red Sox, posted a picture of Hitler. And this is an inaccurate quote about, you know, with that photo that said, to conquer a nation, first, I guess, disarm its citizens. And what Martinez was trying to do was advocate for the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, kind of common sense at this point, I think, with your Instagram accounts. Stay away from the Hitler pictures and any references to Hitler, particularly if you're a pro athlete and people like to scour your Instagram and social media accounts for damaging stuff like this. He made a comment yesterday, sort of explained, like, listen, I didn't intend to do any harm with this, but you got to know your history a little better.
Mm-hmm.
He has a right to express his political viewpoints. I get that. But this is not the way to do it. And I would sort of, you know, stay away from dictators generally in your Instagram feed.
Well, we actually have a little bit of tape of his response speaking to reporters, I think yesterday.
Yes,
about that 2013 post.
You know, as most of you guys know, I'm Cuban American. And most of my family was running to Cuba because of a brutal dictator. And it's terrible. You know, it's one of those things where I was really touched at the time. And, you know, I saw it and I posted it. And, you know, it had no intent to offend anyone. But it was mostly just to state a point that a political point at the time that I believed in.
But Shira, he didn't apologize or say he regretted posting it. What are the Red Sox saying about this?
Yeah, listen, the Red Sox recognize, and it's sort of, it's not sort of, it is MLB policy to let players express their political viewpoints on social media. But Sam Kennedy, while he agrees with that policy and says they can do that, he's warned players, saying, listen, be really careful and know what you're posting. Know the history, know the context, know that it can be misinterpreted. So I think the Red Sox response is to be publicly like, this was not good, obviously,
right,
but also to tell the players both publicly and privately through, you know, publicly through their media and privately in conversation, be very, very careful about what you post because it can be misinterpreted. It's also been reported that in the past, because there have been other major league players who've run into trouble
with
their social...
Right, is this like part of a larger trend?
It is part of a larger trend. You know, Red Sox have said to their players privately, go through your social media accounts and delete stuff that won't show you in a good light. And yes, it has been part of a larger trend. There was the Milwaukee Brewers reliever, Josh Hader, most famously, who had a number of social media posts that were homophobic and racist that came surfaced during Major League Baseball. That got a lot of attention because his hometown fans actually cheered him in the return to the mound. So I think we're going to be hearing more of this, and it's going to, you know, take a while for it to sink in with players.
So do you think this is going to be a distraction for the team going into later in the season?
No, I think this will blow over. There's always some drama with the Red Sox. So this is the drama of the moment. Wait till next week. We'll be talking about some other drama, whether it's on the field or off the field.
Okay, one last drama thing. I don't have time to play the tape, but I do want to ask you about Tom Brady hanging up on WEEI because they asked him about Alex Guerrero's presence. Quickly.
Yes, Tom Brady's personal trainer, Alex Guerrero. Tom Brady does not like to talk about him, and it's a very sensitive subject. Anytime he comes up, Tom Brady ends interviews. This is going to be an ongoing thing this season. It's sort of a, you know, does Guerrero travel with the team? Doesn't he? Who has control of this team? Belichick or Brady? There will be more. We will talk about it more.
We will, and we'll link to that at our website, radioboston.org. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
John Hancock was not one to shy away from the spotlight. A former governor of Massachusetts and the president of the Second Continental Congress, Hancock played a major role in the formation of the United States, one that cannot easily be ignored. Take, for instance, the fact that his signature takes up the most space possible on the Declaration of Independence. But a new play at the Old State House is turning the attention away from his achievements and focuses instead on the lives of the people that surrounded and supported him. The play, Cato and Dolly, chronicles the lives of his wife, Dolly Hancock, and Cato, an enslaved man in the Hancock household. The inspiration for the play was the actual front door of the Hancock house, which was preserved after the mansion was torn down in 1863. The door is now on display at the Old State House. And joining me now in studio is Patrick Gaybridge. He's the writer of Cato and Dolly. He's also the producing artistic director of Plays in Place, a theater company focused on site-specific productions. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about Dolly and Cato. Who were they?
So Cato Hancock was a man who was enslaved in the John Hancock household. When they came to me and said, you know, we want to write a play that's centered around this door from the Hancock household, trying to figure out who are the people that lived in that household, and we're trying to tell some forgotten stories. So Cato Hancock, we don't know a lot about him. It's hard to get facts and information about people whose voices aren't recorded. But we knew enough about him to know where he was married. We know where his children were baptized, and we think we know where he died. And he's also referenced in a number of letters from John Hancock. So we kind of know some times when he's in the household. And he's also referenced in the wills of Thomas and Lydia Hancock, who were John Hancock's aunt and uncle.
So you did a little archival dig on Cato.
We did a big archival dig on Cato. And it was a lot of combing through the record to kind of figure out, well, who are the people that were there that we can know enough about to sketch out a story that, who we haven't heard about a lot.
And did we know more about Dolly?
We know a little bit more about Dolly, which is odd because that we don't know more of her because she was kind of the first lady of Massachusetts. John Hancock was the first governor of Massachusetts. And she was also active when John Hancock was presiding over the Continental Congress. But her writings didn't tend to survive. He wrote to her a lot of times telling her, how come you never write to me? He was kind of a needy guy, but also a very popular politician. What was interesting was we started finding out things that we didn't know or that kind of tended to get overlooked in the historical record about her. So it is interesting that she was there helping him out socially during the Continental Congress. So while they're drafting the Declaration of Independence, she's there serving as social hostess and everything while she's also pregnant.
Wow. So she's almost directly involved with his work there.
She was definitely directly involved with his work. There was not a lot of money in the Continental Congress at that time. So their wives would help them. Like she would stay up late into the night helping him sign papers. There were a lot of papers to sign during the Continental Congress. So she was very involved and also ran the household, and it was a very busy household, very social household. So she's very busy with that.
And you said, again, while pregnant. I mean,
right.
Is that typical of the time? I mean, were their lives typical of women and enslaved people at the time?
I think what's interesting is that when you see history books written as they traditionally have been by white men, the details of people's lives sometimes tend to get overlooked. And so women's roles are overlooked, but also kind of the elements of their lives. So when they're pregnant, or in her case, she loses two children during the war years, essentially, and slightly after the war years. And so trying to understand, you know, what did that mean? And she loses two children and two husbands in the course of her lives. And so what does that mean? What does it mean to be surviving in that kind of household?
And so in thinking about these ideas, did you take a lot of artistic licenses in creating this story?
I had to take some for sure because, again, their voices are not well recorded. So we don't have writings by them. We don't have a lot of letters by them. But so I'm trying to understand how they relate to each other. And both could have been in the household for a long time. We know Cato was in the household from when he was a boy until he was definitely in his 30s, when he was freed at age 30 by Thomas Hancock's will. We don't know exactly when that happened, but we can kind of figure it out. And then we know he stays beyond that, which is kind of interesting. So he's a slave in the household, and then he remains working there as a servant.
Right, he becomes their servant. And then at one point he speaks of missing working and living in their home. And I guess I'm curious about that sort of more positive portrayal of this relationship. I mean, he was enslaved by the Hancocks. Is this true to history?
We don't know exactly how he felt about it, but what we do know is that he had limited options in North America at that time. Because a lot of times we think about slavery as kind of the antebellum period and the Southern slavery model of plantation slavery and house slaves. But New England slavery was very different. And also in this period, so slavery ends in Massachusetts in the early 1780s. But so in this period, when he's a slave in the 1760s and 1770s, there's nowhere for him to go when he's freed particular. It's not like he can't just kind of go. There's no place that doesn't have slavery in North America. So it's not like he's going to go north and become free.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, he has to think about how he's going to align himself with people who can protect him. And he happens to be working for the richest man in Boston in the most powerful household. So he makes, a calculated decision. But he is also part of that household, I think an integral part of that household.
Huh. I want to ask you about your process of telling this story. You're telling this story of a woman and a person of color who's enslaved. What was that process like for you?
I definitely understand that it's a challenge for me. And I write about race a lot in my work. I come from a mixed race family. So issues of race are really important for me to explore to kind of understand my own family. But I think we definitely thought about it a lot, the whole team, and trying to make sure it's just so hard because you don't want to underplay the fact that he was a slave and slavery is terrible. At the same time, he makes a decision to stay. So try to understand why that is and try to understand how households worked in that time period. And it was different from how they work now. So people were very vertically integrated, trying to understand who protects you and who do you protect. Those situations of power were really important.
Right.
And so trying to get that and trying to constantly challenge my lens and think about and, you know, working with the actors and director to bring other points of view, too.
I also want to ask you about this idea of looking back at history. There are conversations throughout the city and the country on renaming things. And just around the corner from the old State House is Faneuil Hall, which some activists have called upon the city to rename. Because its namesake, Peter Faneuil, made money off of slavery and he was a slave owner himself. How do you think this play fits into the reexamination of history and the conversations that we're having right now as a city?
I think the key thing about useful elements of a play like this is it shows the complexity of the questions that we're asking and the question and the complexity of lives at that time period. These are not easy things to figure out. And these were real human beings who had to make really, really hard choices in the situations that they were in. And again, this isn't a play about John Hancock. He figures in, but we made a very conscious decision to have a play with only two actors, a man and a woman. So those two people play everything. So John Hancock is often played by a woman. The actor who plays Cato, he plays like five or six different people. So we're moving across race and gender in the roles that we're playing. And that also helps change and shift the conversation a little bit to make sure we're thinking about how do we approach these as people? How can we shift our lenses?
And in terms of the actual staging of this, you mentioned it was in front of this door.
Right.
And you're putting this on at the old State House, which we know is the oldest public building in Boston. And, you know, because when the Hancock Mansion was torn down, there was this big public outcry that led to a focus on preserving other pre-Revolutionary War buildings in the city. So as someone who uses spaces of historical or cultural significance for your inspiration, what do you think about when you're approaching the telling of a story like this and keeping the physical spaces in mind?
So I worked in this building the last 2 years on a play called Blood on the Snow that was really popular that took place in the old council chamber.
It's about the Boston Massacre,
about the Boston
right?
Massacre in the room where this had happened. So that was a strictly realistic play. This play, because we're not in the room where these things happened, necessitated a non-realistic approach. We knew we had the door there, but we couldn't touch the door. We couldn't go through the door because it's a 300-year-old historic door. So instead, we had to use it as a reference point, as a metaphor to understand how we shape things. So that's why the structure of this play is so different. You know, I'm working on some plays that'll be at Mount Auburn Cemetery next year, and those are all on site. And those are all very different. Each one is dictated by, you know, the place that it's at. And this is the same kind of thing. So what is the door? How do we use it?
Well, so finally, I wanted to ask you about that. What do you hope people who come and see this 24-minute play, as you call it, what do you hope they take away from it?
I think someone was facilitating a discussion for us, and she said, you know, before I saw this play, if I'd walked into this room, I would have said, oh, nice door, and then walked away. And instead, now when they walk in, they think, oh, this door has seen a lot of things, and where these were real people with really complicated lives and relationships. And that's what we need to understand about history, is that it's not simple. And anytime we flatten out history, we don't really understand enough to ask the right questions today. So if we can answer the right questions about the past, we can understand the present much better.
That's Patrick Gaybridge. He's the writer of Cato and Dolly and producing artistic director of Plays in Place, a company focused on site-specific dramas. We've got a lot more information about Cato and Dolly at our website, radioboston.org. Patrick, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced, usually by me, as well as Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. Thanks for listening today, and don't forget to tune in tomorrow, where we've got the talented Chris Siderick in the big chair. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.